All right, we're going to make our way over to the book of Daniel, chapter 11. And I have a question to ask while you're making your way over there. Oh. Has anyone read chapter 11?
Me.
Daniel chapter 11 is the most detailed prophecy in the entire Bible. Nothing compares to this chapter in the whole Bible as far as detail. I've subtitled this passage 2,500 years of prophecy because that's what it covers, 2,500 years and counting. 2,500 years and counting. It is history, I guess you could say, for us. Most of it is history. All of it was future for Daniel, but most of it, all the way up to verse, I think, 34, has pretty much been fulfilled. I do believe some of it will have dual fulfillments. Verses 34 and following, and to the remainder of the chapter, 45 verses in this chapter. So the last part of it is still future, our future even, and it jumps from dealing with a man who was an Antichrist, Antiochus Epiphanes. We've talked about him before, but it jumps from him, who was a forerunner, a very much a type of what Antichrist will be, and it jumps all the way to the very end times, Antichrist himself. Over 100 specific, detailed prophecies have already been fulfilled in this chapter. Already have come to pass. More yet to be fulfilled. That's how complex it is and how detailed it is. Now remember, chapter 10, 11, and 12 comprise one vision. These are the last three chapters, and they are one great vision, his last vision. And it all occurs at the same time. The time it occurs, according to chapter 10, is the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, which, you know, we determined was somewhere around 534 B.C. Now, in verse 1 of chapter 11, you'll notice it says, also in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. This is the angel that's still talking from chapter 10. And what this angel is telling us, he's here at the first year of Darius the Mede. This goes back for years. This spiritual warfare that we talked about last week, it's been raging for years. And it's still raging, of course, and is a unending, no pause in the spiritual warfare raging in the heavens, and they are mirrored in what's going on the earth. They really are. So chapter 11, it appears to be more a spoken revelation than it's called a vision, but it appears to be the angel is giving him all of this information. I've divided into the chapter into a few main sections. The first section is only two verses, verse 1 and 2. That would be the Persian period of the prophecy. The second section covers verses 3, really all the way to verse 35, and that would be the Grecian period. I could divide that up a little bit and make verses 3 through 20, the Grecian period, and 21 through 35, Antiochus Epiphanes. And then the last part is the period covering the end time prophecy, and that's verses 36 through 45. I don't know how far we'll go tonight. It is a very detailed prophecy, and honestly, I have wrestled with this passage for weeks because I don't know what it says, but because it's so detailed that we can bog down in going through each specific fulfillment of each specific detail. Like I said, it is the most specific, the most detailed prophecy in all the Bible. So, verse 1, the same angel that was battling the prince of Persia, remember the prince of Persia, that's the name of this big demon, a fallen angel, that is wanting to influence the king of Persia not to let Israel return to their homeland. There are demon forces, no doubt, that are behind world governments, trying to influence world governments, I believe, all over the world. So there was a great struggle. This is the same angel, probably Gabriel, but his name is never really mentioned. We do know that Israel faced tremendous opposition when they were allowed to return home. 50,000 Jews returned home to rebuild, and they faced immediate opposition, tremendous opposition, and it's interesting that the opposition that they faced on earth was really mirrored in the spiritual realm, because these angels are fighting in the spirit realm. There's, what's happening on earth is, it's mirrored. Maybe it's the opposite. What's happening in the heavenlies is mirrored on earth. But, you know, the great conflicts that occur in the Middle East, let me tell you, the spiritual battle is raging over there. And we see it on earth, but what's happening on earth is mirrored with what's going on in the heavenlies. Spiritual warfare going on all the time. I would remind you also of the main purpose of this whole vision. The angel specified what that was in chapter 10 and verse 14. If you look there with me, here's what the angel told Daniel. Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days. For yet the vision is for many days. What's going to happen to your people? So Daniel's people, remember, are the Jews. So this revelation, this insight into such specific detailed future events mainly concerns Israel, even though it's going to talk about the kings of Greece. It's going to talk about the breakup of Greece into four components, but of the four components, two main kingdoms arise, the kings of the north, kings of the south, and their perpetual war with each other over dominance. And yet it's all about Israel, even though what we're going to read is about warfare between the kings of the north and kings of the south. It's all about that. But here's the thing. Israel's caught in the middle. They're caught right in the middle. So each time one of those armies invaded the other, they passed through. They had to pass through Israel. So, you know, it didn't always bear real well for them. So let's look at the unfolding of this vision, and we'll talk about it as we go. The angel says, verse 2, and now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Well, just a quick reminder that, remember when we saw in chapter 8 and even earlier in chapter 7, the vision of the Grecian leopard that would conquer everything? It had four heads, which would be the four generals, because Alexander the Great was going to die. You know, verse 3 says, and a mighty king shall stand up that will rule with great dominion and do according to his will. This is Alexander the Great. The great king, a mighty king, he would conquer the whole world in 13 years. He's 28 years old, he's lamenting, he's crying, he's mourning, he's depressed because there's no more worlds to conquer. And at the age of 33, he died in a drunken stupor, a fever. Some said he probably died of syphilis or something like that. But 33 years old, he died. But he will rule with great dominion and do according to his will. He could do whatever he wanted. God allowed him that, to conquer the worlds, whatever part of the world he wanted to conquer, he did. But notice verse 4, when he stands up, his kingdom will be broken and divided towards the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. Here again, we see the four winds, because when Alexander died, he died in the peak of life. He died when his kingdom was, he controlled everything. And when he died, he had no heir. There was no Alexander Jr. to take over the empire. So being that he had no heir, the kingdom languished for a while, and then his four generals divided the kingdom up. And we've talked about that before. His four generals, Cassander took Greece and Macedonia. Lysimachus took Asia Minor, Turkey, Thrace. Seleucus took Syria and Babylonia. Ptolemy took Egypt and Palestine. And for 200, 300 years, these guys fought each other, constantly struggling for supremacy, who was going to be boss. So this is just a little bit of the background of this passage. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to point out that in verse 2 about the kings of Persia, it says, the fourth shall be far richer than they all. Most commentators agree that that was Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther. Under his influence, the Persian Empire spread to its maximum. They had 127 provinces. So you actually can go through here and you can match this king, this king, this king is who it's talking about. So this is the guy. The fourth king is the guy that took Esther as his wife.
Yeah, in verse 2, he says, I'll tell you the truth. I'm going to read this in the New King James. Three more kings will arise in Persia. The fourth will be far richer than them all by his strength. And through his riches, he'll stir up all against the realm of Greece. The fourth king would go to war against Greece. He would be the strongest of them all. The four kings, history tells us that the four kings that reigned after Cyrus were Cambyses II, Pseudo-Smerodus, Darius I, Histopis, and Xerxes. Xerxes, this guy had an army that numbered in the millions. Xerxes also is the one who is called Ahasuerus, King Ahasuerus, in the book of Esther. He's the one who had the big feast, Esther chapter 1, called for his wife Vashti, the queen, to come, remember? And when she wouldn't come, well, that he's the one that that Esther wound up becoming his queen. There were other kings, Persian kings, over the next years, but they're not named. But one who became very important later to Israel was Artaxerxes. He's the king that allowed Nehemiah to rebuild over in Nehemiah chapter 2. Actually, there's a gap from the end of chapter 2 to the time you get to chapter 3. There's about a 150-year gap. So sometimes prophecy does that thing, you know, does those kind of things. It'll jump. But so the Grecian period, Alexander the Great, verse 3, he died in 323 B.C. without an heir. His kingdom was divided toward the four winds. And his, even though his kingdom was divided between four generals, there were really two that became very powerful. The northern region went to Lysimachus, and it never really did amount to a whole lot. The southern part went to Ptolemy. This was basically Egypt, the land of Palestine. The Ptolemies became very powerful. Egypt became powerful again. And the eastern part, which was Seleucus, Seleucus ruled Syria and Persia, Iraq. And even though he ruled the eastern part, he is called the northern king. Because you have to understand, whenever you read about the northern king, the southern king, It's always geographically in relationship to where Israel is. So the northern king is north. Syria is north of Israel, and even though that was part of the Eastern Empire, he's called the king of the north, the Seleucus, and that would be the Seleucid Empire. And then the king of the south, that would be the Ptolemies, that would be Egypt. So when we read, and you're going to be reading about, and the king of the north did this, and the king of the south did this, and this is what they did, well, it's always in relation to Israel, geographically. What follows is very, very detailed accounts of wars, intrigue, attacks, counterattacks, plots, schemes, subterfuge. I'm going to read all the way to verse 20. I'm going to read it to you in the King James. I'm going to read it actually in the New King James. I apologize. Just a little bit of clarity. But beginning in verse 5, the king of the south shall become strong. The king of the south is who? This is the Ptolemies. This is Egypt. He'll become strong as well as one of his princes. He will gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years, they'll join forces. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. You know, this is what kings did. They'd marry their daughter. They're gonna marry Berenice off to form a compact, but it didn't work. Nothing ever worked between these guys. She shall not retain the power of her authority. Neither he nor his authority will stand. She shall be given up with those who brought her and with those who begot her and with them who strengthened her in these times. But from a branch of her roots one shall arise in his place who shall come with an army into the fortress of the king of the north and deal with them and prevail. Now, a lot of details are going on right here. This agreement that it talks about in verse 6 was a peace treaty that was proposed by Antiochus II to marry Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy II. There was a problem. Antiochus already had a wife, and she was a very powerful, influential woman whose name was Laodice. She didn't like being no more a wife of the king and being divorced. But that's what he did, because the Ptolemies said, look, the Ptolemy said, you marry my daughter, we'll make this treatment, you got this treaty, you got to get rid of your wife. So he divorced his wife. And he married Berenice. But when Ptolemy died, he divorced Berenice, made her a concubine, and took his first wife back. But his first wife never forgave him for divorcing. So she killed him. These were nice people, you know. She poisoned him and if I'm not mistaken, killed her son, and then, or killed the son that they had, that the king had with Berenice, is what it was. Not her own. So you've got all of these plots, and you know, this verse 6. This is a whole new generation of kings, and but the prophecy here says, I'm going to read this just a little bit of this history. She managed to have Berenice and her infant son assassinated. The king, she poisoned him. And then she had a group of people who followed her, engineered a coup that put her in power as queen while her son was young. But, you know, in this manner, the prophecy was fulfilled concerning Berenice. She would be handed over, that is, given up, along with the nobles who supported her in Antioch. I'll tell you, the biggest struggle you have is how detailed are we going to get into some of this history. Verse 7, out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate. So this this speaks of a great force that would go against Syria. Am I reading in verse 6? Verse 7? Which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. Oh, boy. So there's a war here that rages from 246 to 241. Ptolemy is avenging the death of his daughter here. He returns to Egypt with great spoil that he conquered from the king of the north. And after some period of time, he gains control of some portions of Thrace. Verse 8, he shall also carry away captives into Egypt with their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and gold, and shall continue more years than the king of the north. The Syrian gods was seized and taken off into Egypt, and vast wealth was taken off into Egypt as well. Verse 9, so the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and return to his own land. So now you have Seleucus having control of Syria and Phoenicia. Verse 10, his sons will be stirred up and assemble a multitude of great forces. One shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. Well, all the way, let me read on down.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
A minute ago you said Ptolemy died. When Ptolemy died, his daughter, the wife, Berenice, she kind of lost power. But then now you're relating all these other things.
There were a succession of Ptolemies, succession of...
Actually, that you were talking about, this is not the same one you're talking about now in these scriptures, right?
No, that's right. Years pass.
Okay.
This jumps. This years pass between some of these events, many years. But, you know, I guess the point that I would make is that each of these prophecies, historians have found, have been specifically fulfilled, every single one. And look, these are historical events that you can't deny that these things happened. In fact, it's so detailed, the prophecies of different attacks and wars and so on, they're so detailed that the skeptics and critics have said this book of Daniel could not have been written that long ago. It had to be written after the fact, you know, because no human being can know the future in that much detail, which is true. But God knows the end from the beginning. So I will continue to read these passages, but I think what I'll do is print out, because we could spend weeks here. I think what I'll do is print out how they were fulfilled and make that available to anybody who wants to read it. I'll have to do that in the next couple of days, so I'll have them for everybody Sunday, because I'm going to bog everybody down here, including myself. But let's see where we left off. And we'll continue. And the king of the south will be moved with choler, anger, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. He will set forth a great multitude. The multitude will be given in his hand. So again, you've got it's one invasion after another. The king of the north invades the south. King of the south invades the north. It's a counterattack. It's subterfuge. It's lies. It's deception. They try and work out treaties. The treaties never last. They betray one another. You know what intrigue is with kings and kingdoms and The king of the north will return and set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south, even the robbers of thy people. There were wicked Jews that threw in with the armies. I guess maybe they were bribed or just had their own agenda. But they joined in the revolt, and they would, look, they shall fall. It would fail. So the king of the north shall come, verse 15, and cast out up a mound and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that comes against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. Well, what you've got here is the Syrian Empire is going to give to the king of the south, Ptolemy, the daughter of women. This is Cleopatra. This is Cleopatra, the first Cleopatra. You know, there was a whole bunch of Cleopatras. I think there were seven of them. So this is the first Cleopatra. And she was supposed to betray Egypt, but instead she betrayed her father. She wouldn't stand on his side, neither he be for him. After this, he'll turn his face to the isles and take many, but a prince for his own behalf will cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he will cause it to turn upon him. Like I said, I'm going to print out something for you. So you can go over many of these things. Antiochus the Great gave his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy. That's the idea. He gave her, Antiochus the Great did this, and she was supposed to betray Ptolemy, but she didn't. She sided with him, and this caused a great reproach against him. And verse 19, he'll turn his face toward the fort of his own land. He'll stumble and fall and not be found. And then his successor would stand up in his estate, a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days, he'll be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. He would die. Some say he was poisoned to death. And then it changes a little bit because we begin to look at the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 21 tells us that in his estate, now again, this is the Syrian Empire, the kings of the north, will stand up a vile person, a contemptible person, a despicable person. I find it interesting that the angel calls Antiochus Epiphanes a despicable person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he'll come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. He actually cheated his way into the throne, onto the throne. He wasn't the rightful heir, but he succeeded in flattering the Romans, and they didn't know who the rightful heir was. They allowed him to rise to power. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him. He'll be broken and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. This probably refers to Antiochus. This, by the way, is Antiochus Epiphanes now. This is the one who called himself God. This is Antiochus Epiphanes who murdered the Jewish high priest. When it talks about he also the prince of the covenant, he murdered the Jewish high priest in 171 B.C., set up his own high priest. And after the league made with him, he'll work deceitfully, for he will come up, he will become strong with a small people. He started out small, but he rose to power quickly, Antiochus Epiphanes. He will enter peaceably even to the fattest places of the provinces. He'll do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He'll scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches. He'll forecast his devices against the strongholds. He'll stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he will not stand, for they will forecast devices against him. Antiochus was able to overcome a larger force. The Egyptians' force was larger, but some of Ptolemy's own people betrayed him, treasonous, which the very next verse says, yea, they that feed off the portion of his meat will destroy him, and his army will overflow, and many slain. So he was betrayed by his own people in his own government. Both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief. They're neither one of them any good. They're all despicable people. They will speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Isn't this interesting? They will speak lies at one table. Here you have two great politicians making a treaty. What are they doing? Speaking lies. Speaking lies at one table. Yeah. Only when their mouth is moving, huh? Verse 28, then shall he return to his land with great riches. You know, Antiochus, after he defeated this overwhelming Egyptian force, he plundered Egypt. He plundered them. He took great spoil. He marched through the Holy Land and attacked and plundered and destroyed and pillaged. Tens of thousands of Jews were killed at this time. His heart would be against the Holy Covenant, verse 28 says, and he will do exploits and return to his own land. He is a type of Antichrist in his persecution of the Jews. At the time appointed, he will return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. Now, here's what happens in verse 30. The ships of Chittim, this actually represents Rome, would come against him. And therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Here's what happened. Antiochus determined. Ptolemy had been weakened. The Egyptian Empire was staggering. It was very weak at this time. Antiochus decided, I'm going to just wipe them out. So he had a great army marching against Egypt to wipe them off the face of the earth, basically. He was going to actually annex Egypt into his empire. But the ships of Chittim, Rome at this point was gaining much power. They were growing really strong. And they sent an ambassador, one guy, and I'm sure he had an entourage, but they sent this one guy to confront Antiochus. And Antiochus is marching towards Rome. Have you ever heard the expression, I'm going to draw a line in the sand? Yeah. Well, this Roman ambassador drew a line in the sand because Antiochus is determined he's going to go get Rome. But Egypt, the king of the south, had signed a mutual aid treaty with Rome. And Rome said they would honor the treaty. Mutual aid treaty. So if Egypt was in trouble, Rome would come to their aid. If Rome was in trouble, Egypt would come to their aid. Mutual aid. They had signed a treaty. So now Antiochus is facing this Roman ambassador, and the Roman ambassador drew a circle around him. And he told him, if you proceed, all the might of Rome is coming against you. And so He was strong, but he wasn't as strong as Rome, and he knew it. Dave?
And it's kind of interesting that in these few verses, that's a period of the Maccabees. So even though we don't accept the first and second Maccabees as inspired, they give it a lot of history, and they fill in a lot of this about Antiochus' persecution of the Jews.
Yeah, actually, the next verse is when the Maccabean revolt took place, because when Rome turned Antiochus around, when they sent him packing, he was so angry, he had to go back through Israel, and he just plundered Israel. And he took out all of his rage, all of his frustration, all of his anger on the Jews. He massacred tens of thousands. This is when, well, the very next verse talks about, verse 31, arms shall stand on his part. They will pollute the sanctuary of strength. They'll take away the daily sacrifice. They'll place the abomination that makes desolate. This is when he came in and basically determined that he would eradicate Judaism and make them all Greeks. That he actually killed anybody caught with copies of the scriptures. He desecrated the holy place, set up an altar of Zeus in the temple, demanded that the Jews worship it. Any children that were circumcised, if they found a child circumcised, they killed them. They slaughtered pregnant women. They forced Jews to eat pigs. You know, Jews would not eat pigs, but they forced them. You eat the pig. They had knives. They had swords to their throats. You eat the pig or you die. They wouldn't allow them to celebrate, you know, their Sabbaths. They basically forbade their religion. It was so oppressive that it caused a great revolt among the Jews. In fact, the very next verse says, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. This refers to the Maccabean revolt that occurred at this time. The people that know their God would revolt, that they would do exploits. The Maccabeans, we talked about them before. The book of 1 Maccabees is an accurate historical account of their revolt when actually Julius the Hammer Maccabeus, the son of the father, carried on the revolt, and they overthrew Antiochus. They overthrew his forces. He himself had to leave because of some other thing going on somewhere else, but they overthrew his forces, his army, drove them out, cleansed the temple. This is when they reinstituted sacrifice, you know, all of this in the Maccabean revolt. They would be strong and do exploits. This is when the oil burned, you know, for 8 days when they only had 1 day worth of oil, and started the Feast of Lights. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity, by spoil, many days. When they fall, they will be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for the time appointed. We begin in these verses that I just read to transition to we're going to go from Antiochus Epiphanes to a fellow called here a willful king. Verse 36, the king shall do according to his will. So one of the titles of Antichrist, you know, he's got many titles: beast, Antichrist, man of perdition, son of perdition. One of the titles of Antichrist is also the willful king, and it comes from this verse right here. He will do according to his will, and he will exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Now, many think that this was fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes, and certainly some things were. But you know, there are passages, prophetic passages, that have multiple fulfillments. This passage actually speaks about Antichrist. And this one verse says five things specifically about Antichrist. Notice what it says. He will do according to his own will. That is, Antichrist will answer to no one. There'll be no one above him. He won't be answering to Rome. He won't be answering to anybody but himself. He will be a world dictator. He will have absolute authority. And it's interesting, the Bible speaks of God as the one who does according to his will. You know, Daniel chapter 4 and verse 35 says, all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the armies of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And no one can stay his hand or say, what doest thou? But the Bible speaks of a couple of people, Alexander the Great, who did according to his will. We read about that in verse 3. Antiochus in verse 16. And this guy, Antichrist, in verse 36, who does according to his will. He's the willful king. Notice something else it says about Antichrist. Verse 36. He will exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. He's a boaster. He's arrogant. If you look up pride in the dictionary, you know, his picture would be there. He is a self-exalting narcissist. If ever there was a narcissist, this would be it. Of course, he's going to proclaim that he is God himself. A third thing, he's going to speak blasphemies. Notice, he's going to exalt himself above every god. He will speak marvelous things, blasphemous things against the God of gods. He is a blasphemer. We know from other passages we've read previously, Revelation chapter 13 talks about the Antichrist, the beast who will speak great things. He'll have a mouth speaking blasphemies and so forth. So his mouth will be filled with blasphemy, mockery, ridicule of God. He will prosper. This is another thing it says about him. He will prosper till the indignation be accomplished, until the wrath be accomplished. He will prosper until God's wrath is done. So throughout the tribulation period, which is called the wrath of God, once God's wrath is accomplished, once he's done dealing with mankind and Israel in particular, then he will no longer prosper. And the last thing it says about him, for that is determined shall be done. Everything that God said would happen will come to pass. Now, there's some interesting things said about him in verse 37 that we don't read elsewhere about Antichrist. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. Many believe that this is a possible reference to Antichrist being a Jew, the God of his fathers. There are some translations, however, that translate God here in the plural, that he would not recognize, that he would not regard the gods of his fathers, and some think that that might indicate that he's a Gentile, an idolater, or comes from that kind of a background. I like the King James translation, which is singular. It tells me that Antichrist will most likely come from a monotheistic religion, or at least he will have that in his background. He himself acknowledges no God. He's a anti-God. You know, he believes he's God. But Antichrist could very likely have some Jewish blood in him. Some think maybe Arab blood, maybe a combination of the two. It also says this about him, which is a little bit mysterious because we don't know exactly what it means. Not only will he not regard the God of his fathers, but nor the desire of women. So some think that that might mean he's a homosexual, that he has no desire for women. And that's, I think, a possibility. It's also possible that, you know, a narcissist, if you've ever known a narcissist, a true narcissist, you know, the whole word narcissism comes from the Greek mythology. Narcissus was the god who fell in love with himself. He saw his reflection in the mirror, in a pond. His reflection was so beautiful, he couldn't leave. He fell in love with himself, looking at himself in the pond, touching himself, talking, you know, his reflection. And he wound up starving to death because he fell in love with his own image. Well, a narcissist loves himself or herself, and they have no room in their heart. There is actually no room in their heart to love anybody else. So when it speaks here about having no regard, or he doesn't have, you know, this love for women, it could be he's so in love with himself, such a narcissist, he don't love nobody really, which is another possibility, that Antichrist knows no loyalty, no love of anyone at any time. Is it possible he could be a homosexual? Yes, it's quite possible. Yes, sir.
If it's the first one, that would make him even worse than Hitler, because at least Hitler loved Eva Braun.
I guess he did. He is another definite type of Antichrist, him and Stalin, and I guess you could name half a dozen others in history. Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, Idi Amin, probably this guy over here in North Korea. Also, look at what else it says about him right here in this verse, verse 37. Nor the desire of, nor regard any god, no god. He will be a unbelieving, apostate, reprobate, godless atheist. For he shall magnify himself above all, which tells me he's the very epitome of a narcissist. You know, this guy is basically the devil incarnated. Verse 38, but in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. Basically, forces here is power, arms, strength. That's the one thing he worships. Might, power, dominion, strength. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. He's going to amass a fortune, and he will spend it to amass power, to amass, become the most powerful dictator that the earth has ever seen. He'll spend a massive fortune to become the most powerful leader on earth that has ever been. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and shall cause them to rule over many. He will divide the land for gain. Well, he will reward those who help him, is what it amounts to gain power. And verse 40 says, and at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and enter into the countries. He shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. So now you got a king of the south and a king of the north, but here I don't think it's talking anymore about Syria and Egypt, but rather a coalition of power. The king of the north would have to certainly be Russia. And Syria, but a coalition of nations, I believe. And the kings of the south here would certainly be Egypt, but also probably Arab countries, maybe Muslim countries. And so they're going to oppose Antichrist, but he will defeat them. That's what this is. He will defeat them. He'll pass right through them. and conquer even more lands. They won't stop him. And verse 41, he'll enter also into the glorious land. That's, of course, Israel. Many countries will be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now, this is land that's currently modern Jordan. In fact, it talks here about the children of Ammon. Ammon, A-M-M-A-N, is the capital city of Jordan. And it's actually a... it's actually derived from this word Ammon right here, the children of Ammon. And some believe that this will be a sort of a fortress, a refuge for the Jews during the Great Tribulation, a place for them to hide. And he will stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He will have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north will trouble him. Therefore, he'll go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. This tidings from the north, or the east rather, is likely China and its 200 million man army. Fireworks? Wow. 4th of July weekend. So what you've got here is probably tidings out of the east. You know, you've got a Chinese coalition, and from the south, you may be, again, a Muslim coalition. The Antichrist is going to have his own troubles right at the end. But there's an interesting final verse here. It says, he'll plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountains and come to his end, and none will help him. The armies of the world, basically, is what is saying here. The armies of the world are going to be gathered together, and he will have his armies at this place between the seas. He's talking about between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. There's a great big valley there, a big plain. It's called Megiddo, the Valley of Megiddo, where everything comes to its final place. And he will come to his end, and there'll be no one to help him. So what I would like to do, because I think today we ran over a whole lot of verses, and tried to give you a basic summary of all of this. What I will do is I will print out a historical, how this was fulfilled historically, so you can actually sit down and look. Every one of these prophecies, over 100 prophecies have been completely fulfilled, detailed prophecies, everything that this passage said would happen. Look, this is 2,500 years ago. And all of this has come to pass except for the last 10 verses. Shouldn't we believe that the last 10 verses will come to pass as well? That they would be perfectly fulfilled as well, literally fulfilled as well? I mean, I think we should have the confidence to believe that they would. So, I apologize tonight if it was a bit confusing, but what's that? Yeah. it's very detailed, and it can be quite confusing, but historians have gone through this through the years and have seen every bit of it. They can relate every bit of it to history, and it happened exactly as it said it would, over a period, of course, of hundreds of years. And here we are, 2,500 years later, waiting for the last 10 verses to come to pass. I never thought we'd get through 45 verses tonight, but that might be a record. Well, We'll quit there. We're not going to do chapter 12 tonight. Father, we do thank you for the opportunity to study together. And Lord, our desire always is to honor you and exalt you and to recognize that you are the God of all knowledge, the God of history, the God of the present, the God of the future. And Lord, help us to realize that you know exactly what will transpire in the world. Nothing at all ever takes you by surprise. So help us, Lord, to walk in peace, no matter what events are going on in our world. Lord, you know the end from the beginning, and you reign in the kingdoms of men as well as in heaven. So, Father, help us to trust you on a daily basis, to trust you in our personal, individual lives and affairs and circumstances, and to trust you to keep every promise you made, just as you fulfill every one of these detailed prophecies. Lord, help us to trust you to keep your word to us, your promises to us, each and every one of them, and to walk in confidence and joy and peace even in the midst of a tumultuous world. Fill our hearts with your peace, your knowledge, the knowledge of your presence with us and for us, and bless us as we go, I pray. Use us for your glory, I ask. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen. Praise the Lord.